Too Brief podcast, where we interview individuals just like you dealing with their own journey from loss to growth, along with mental health experts, growth guides, all with the purpose of helping you heal better, improve mind, body, and spirit, and find your new purpose from the loss and the tragedy that you've experienced. Hi, I'm Tom Pasello. I'm your host, a growth evangelist, as well as a fellow widower, having lost my beautiful bride of 19 years, Judy, some four, now almost 5 years ago. Today, we've got a special guest, Jeff Johnston. Jeff is a successful entrepreneur, husband, and father. And Jeff's world would be forever changed 5 years ago when he got the call that his eldest son died of a fentanyl poisoning. And then 2 years ago, Jeff experienced another loss, losing his wife, Prudence, to alcoholism. Since then, he's dedicated his life to what he calls living undeterred, created a mental health charity around that, wrote the book, This One's For You, An Inspirational Journey Through Addiction, Death, and Meaning. We'll post that to our recommended book section. And then he created the Living Undeterred podcast and so much more. We're going to explore all of what he's been up to since experiencing those tragedies and finding new meaning and purpose. Welcome, Jeff Johnston.
Tom, it's an honor to be here on the show. I'm really excited to talk to your followers and listeners, but really talk with them. You know, this is not about a lecture. This isn't any, I don't have a rules to life type thing. It's just how I've reacted to the situation that was given to me and kind of how my mindset's been reframed. That there's some lessons in all this. I mean, I'm sure in talking to you for the first time, there's some lessons I learned, and that's the beauty of this whole journey I'm on, is that by sharing stories and becoming vulnerable, we can help each other.
Absolutely. Now, 6 years ago, this is 7 years ago, 2016, October. Tell us kind of where you were at, and then you get this life-changing phone call.
Yeah, I mean, if you would have met me 6, 7 years ago, I was a completely different person. Pretty much your capitalist, you know, running an investment firm, traveling the world, couldn't have a car fast enough. You know, my wife, my beautiful wife, you know, 9 years younger than me, and seemed to have it all from the perception of everybody else, you know, three boys all doing well. But you know, like every family, underlying was some cracks. You know, I had been an alcoholic since high school, probably 5, 6 day a week alcoholic. So I call that a functional alcoholic. Had a bout with about 2 decades of gambling, which, you know, that comes from just being a type A competitive type person. Fortunately, I never did drugs, but, you know, October 4th, 2016 was that day where I was literally sitting there patting myself on the back, you know, telling myself how great I was and how successful I was. And I'd kind of reached that pinnacle I worked so hard at when I was 23. And, you know, the phone rings just like you see in the movies. And I just looked at the phone. It was 6:30 in the morning. And I just knew that something horrific was on the other line. And, they found our oldest son, Seth, dead in a hotel room, poisoned by fentanyl in his heroin, about a mile away from where his little brother was golfing that day for state districts. So as my middle son was going to the first tee, looking around where mom and dad were, his biggest fans, you know, we were at the hotel, with the yellow tape around it, talking to the cops, what happened to our son. So, you know, I knew that my life was never going to be the same. And Seth was a beautiful boy. You know, he's a great, great kid. I was very fortunate to have the time I did have with him, and try to honor, like I say to my kids, honor the dead, live for the living, do what we can the best way possible. And so I really, you know, that was my first really traumatic event in my life. I had never had any abuse as a child. I grew up in the Leave It to Beaver family, you know. And to think I got 52 years on this planet, pretty unscathed, you know, I was pretty lucky, you know, but there came death, you know, boom. And so I knew it was important for me to present this in an optimistic way to my kids, you know, something good had to come from this. And so the day we told the boys that their brother died, my wife was sitting over to the right, you know, she was a wreck, and obviously, and then my two boys are to the left. And, I said this, and I didn't rehearse this, and I'm not really sure, Tom, where it came from, but it's a important part of my book called The Two Roads. And I knew, you know, when you ask someone to marry you and you have kids, you know that over your lifetime, you're going to have, I call them dad moments, you know? And I mean, they're very few. There's like five in your whole lifetime where something happens and you're going to say something that's impactful. And what you say can really dictate the quality of the rest of your family's life. And when there's a death in the family and you got a 15 and a 13-year-old that lost their older brother at 23, it's pretty important for me to write that ship. And so I said, you know, boys, we have one of two roads to go down. And this was my chapter in my book. It's called The Two Roads, and kind of where the whole living undeterred idea came into my head. I said, boys, we have one of two roads to go down. We have one road of anger, despair, and hatred, and we'll become alcoholics and addicts ourselves. Or we have a road of inspiration and motivation. This can be the single greatest moment in our lives and those around us to make a difference. I'm on the second road. I ask you to join me. And, you know, I've said it so many times now, I think I say it without even thinking, but I was pretty proud of myself when I said it because A, I didn't rehearse it. And B, I was very authentic that I didn't want to tell them how to grieve. I wanted to show them what I was going to do. And my halftime speech worked great. My two boys have done some amazing things. I mean, Ian alone, if you look at what he's done for advocacy, and he was the Iowa Junior Philanthropist of the Year 2 years ago for raising money. He's got an award named after him at his high school called the Ian Johnston Award for Courage. He was given the Courage Award in college for his college golf team. But, you know, I didn't listen to what I just said because for 14 months after Seth died, I drank 7 days a week.
I was going to say.
And I didn't want to live.
Yeah, it's one thing to have that speech and to talk about it, but
I didn't live it.
I'd be hurting, yeah. And there's a subconscious element, even if consciously you were saying, look, I'm going to take the high road.
And I felt like a hypocrite. I felt like a hypocrite.
Yeah.
I felt like
subroutines that run.
Yeah. Right?
And if you're an addict like you were with alcoholism, because I was too through that process, those routines are going to run.
Yeah. So I mean, I wrote the book. I did the podcast even. I did lots of advocacy work. I'm very active on LinkedIn, but I was just getting drunk every day and I didn't really care to live. I didn't want to die, but I didn't want to live. It's a weird dynamic. And then I noticed my wife was getting really bad. Prudence was just, you know, her alcoholism was worse than mine. And so on December 24th, 2017, I had that famous epiphany moment where I just looked in the mirror down in Florida. We had a condo and my wife and I got drunk the night before. And, you know, I was done, man. I was just done. And as a fellow male about the same age as me, when you make those pivots in your life, you just know it's over. I knew that chapter of my life was over.
Yeah.
And I didn't need a lot of inspiration. I just buried a son. I'm losing my wife. It's like, what other freaking inspiration do I need? Yeah. No AA meeting is going to make me feel any more motivated. Nothing. There's no drug on the planet that can make me more motivated to fix my life than watching my family fall apart. And so I quit. And it's been the easiest thing I've ever done in my life. I'm not kidding you. And this is a full-blown alcoholic for 30 years. I don't even call myself sober because that implies that I'm in a fight. I just don't drink. It's that pragmatic. It's that simple for me. I could go to meetings. Sure. I like talking to people. I'm not defiant. I'm not angry at alcohol. I just don't drink. And if I had a drink today, I wouldn't tell everybody I fell off the wagon. I wouldn't care. I just, you know what I'd say, Tom? I'd say I had a drink today. And so my journey into grief and all this started really with my relationship with alcohol, how I just turned it off. I just said, I'm done. And so, you know, that worked great for me, right? Well, it didn't work great for my wife. And on June 29th, 2021, a day after my youngest son's 18th birthday, mom dies, alcoholism, age 46, married 21 years. And, you know, I hate to say these things because it sounds disparaging and my wife's not here to defend herself, but, you know, it was suicide by alcohol. That's what it was. I don't know how else to say it. And I'm not triggerable. So I can't get triggered. I worry about me triggering other people when I make statements like that, but I pretty much tell it the way it is. I'll talk to you about another incident I had in December of last 2 years ago, but the purpose of me sharing these stories isn't about people. You know, I'm like you, Tom. You and I are a lot very similar. We're not looking for sympathy and pity, right? But we are looking for love, compassion, empathy, courage, strength. Those are things you can actually, through your exchanging of energy, you can actually give that to other people. And we today just give too much hate and anger and fear and all these things that are so abundant. So I became very quickly not that angry Iowa dad. I'm not that angry advocate. I'm not that let's fentanyl weapon of mass destruction. Let's eradicate alcohol. Let's, you know, blah, blah, blah. I mean, I don't have any anger in my heart. I just don't. I don't. I think we can love our way out of this problem. I really do.
Yeah. The alcoholism that you're able to stop on your terms exactly when you had kind of hit that rock bottom point for you, it's very, very similar for me. I didn't go to meetings. I didn't do anything like that. It was just, I woke up that day after my wife passed away, having gotten drunk and kind of sorrow, drowning my sorrow with my drinking buddy, polished off 4 bottles of wine together, hung out, and I woke up with a hangover the next day. And I'm like, that's it. This can't continue. I've got to be sober right. through this. I've got to feel right. everything because right. by feeling everything and not numbing it, I could then understand. I can finally feel what I've been drowning through the whole sickness process up until that right. point. And that was a really important point for me because it was that switch to then turn it to, okay, I don't have to be going down the same route anymore, because I knew that if I would have continued drinking, I would have ended up like Penelope. I don't think I would have lasted another 2 years.
Yeah. That. Yeah. Me too.
And it was a big catalyst for a lot. I wound up losing 60 pounds. I wound up getting yep. to a fitness level and a clarity level that I hadn't had.
I did too. Prior.
Yeah. And I think that there's an importance in that. So not, and I don't mind being around people that drink.
I don't either. I buy drinks for my friends all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
Exactly. So it's not that I think it's, you know, for some people continue to socially drink, you know, but right. when you're drowning in it at home by yourself to cover up feeling, I think then it becomes that issue where it's really an important part of the grief journey for me was getting off of alcohol, probably the most important.
So one of the things I really decided to lean into, I've got another quote that I really like. It's lean into it to learn from it. Mm-hmm. And it's something I say to my boys. So, you know, death came into my life 2 times in a short amount of time as an opportunity for me to become a better man, not a bitter man. Mm-hmm. And that's the only way I framed it. It's not a curse. It's not a punishment. Matter of fact, if you live long enough, you know, simple math says people are going to die around you. My dad's 90. All of his friends are dead. Yeah. I said, Dad, you know, he's a doctor. He's like, what do you expect? He lived to 90. No one's going to be around. Well, I said, you just got to get new friends, right? He said, yeah. So, you know, and that's the attitude that we should have, but that's not the attitude we have because our expectations are so out of whack. We just expect every day to be unicorns and rainbows. And many days it is. But, you know, I decided to understand grief and understand the narratives and understand the terminology. And so one phrase I came up with that really is from Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, when he said, what did he say? Suffering is my opportunity, he said in the book. I got to thinking, I like that phrase, but how can I rephrase it into my situation? So I came up with a phrase that I use now, and it's pain is unavoidable. Suffering is a choice. And so the pain of losing a child, that's unavoidable. And you cannot do anything about that pain. You certainly can do something about the suffering.
Yes.
Suffering is a byproduct of pain. You know, suffering doesn't happen prior to pain. Pain comes first, then you suffer. So it's like for me, okay, I'm not going to fight the pain. So when I cry hard. It's like, man, I really lean into crying now. It's like a mental health workout. It's like, you know, when's the last time you ever went to the gym and busted your butt and walked out of there and felt worse? You know, yeah. When have you cried the hardest over your wife, Judy, Tom, and felt worse? Yeah. Never. It's not possible. And so now I don't fight these things when they come. It's like, I numbed it with alcohol and things like that. But now mm-hmm. it's like my mental health workout. It's like, okay, what can I take from this experience to make my journey more enjoyable, you know? And it's almost a perverse way to think about death, but I respect death. I don't hate it. It gives me appreciation for being alive. I feel lucky I'm not dead, you know?
I love what you're saying in that feel. You're going to feel. You can't control that a lot of times. Scream at the top of your lungs, cry your eyes out. But there's a choice that occurs after that feeling, which is your choice to believe the world, as Einstein says, kind of a safe place or a hostile place, right?
Right.
And if you think it's a hostile place, then you're going to suffer. And if you think it's a safe place, well, then you're going to find new purpose, which is what Viktor Frankl says is the meaning of life.
Yeah.
Talk about that choice. And because we see so many widowers feel like they're stalled or feel like they're stuck in their grief and they just can't kind of get out of the mud. For you, for me, it was a conscious choice to say, look, I'm going to feel. But my choice is to live, and not only to live every day, just surviving, but to kind of create a new purpose and a new life that's going to be bigger and, I wouldn't say better than before, but that I become a better man, a better.
No,
better
it is you. Better. It is better. It's better. It really is. I mean that sincerely. And it's intentional. I'm very intentional with things now. And, you know, one thing I really wanted to be really clear on was to really fall in love with myself all over again. So now June coming up here, I'll be widowed 2 years. I haven't been on a date. I haven't entertained a conversation with anybody. I haven't been flirtatious. And it's not, I feel lonely. I mean, it sucks around Christmas. And today's my birthday, by the way. I'm 57 today. It'd be great to go out with a girlfriend or something and have dinner and romance and all that stuff. But that'd be premature. And I need to fall back in love with myself. I need to really connect. And so many widowers fall right into a relationship. I mean, right into it, like quickly. And then they never had a chance to have that opportunity to fall in love with themselves because now they're giving all that love to somebody else. And I don't want to do that. I'm not saying I don't want to be in a relationship. I do. I tell my boys all the time, man, I'm lonely. I mean, it sucks to be 57 and sit in my studio all day and do podcasts, but I don't have to sit there and deal with all the stuff that comes to be in a relationship. It would take me away from my passions, and that's mental health right now. So I'm intentional. I understand there's some downside to not being in a relationship at this age because I have the financial means. I'm in good shape. I could share my life with somebody. I would love that. But man, I have to fall in love with Jeff Johnston. I have to be in a good place. I can't give love if I don't love myself. And I think the one advice I would give to widow and widowers is just slow your roll after your spouse dies. Just, you know, there's no obligation to have to get back into a relationship. And if you do, all you're going to do is just run from, you know, one to another. And really you got to figure out what's most important for you. And I think that's so key. That's so key. There'll be a time. I mean, there's some people I've met in my journey that, you know, if they lived around here, if they weren't married, you know, sounds terrible, but it's not the time. It's not the place. And so I just move on. You know, I don't torture myself, but that's an example of being intentional as a widower, especially for men, is it's very, I think society looks at a single man at 57 that maybe has done well financially, but doesn't have anyone to share with kind of as, oh, what's wrong with Jeff, you know? But I'm okay with it. But, you know, so again, I think there's little bits and pieces of all of our stories that we can share with people. And one of them is, especially when you lose your spouse, take that opportunity to really get to know who you are before you go into some other relationship.
Yeah.
I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah. This is from someone who did get into a relationship right away. The process was the long one I went through the grieving of even before she passed away, through the disease process of 10 years. So I lost her in bits and pieces over that time. And I was in need of affection, love, reinforcement externally. I wasn't in love with myself. I felt like a complete loser because the biggest battle in life was, can I save my spouse? Can I be that hero? And I couldn't do that. And so I was very vulnerable. And at the time, trainer at the gym was all over to help me to improve and was attractive, had a lot going for him, and it was easy.
Yeah.
But I wasn't ready. And because of that, in one way I was vulnerable, and another wasn't ready to share or really be in a mature relationship. And so I had to do that work in pieces over time. Whereas I think your way of doing is say, look, I'm going to give myself that time. I'm going to give myself that space is important. Until you can write out what your values are and what you value and who you are and what you value in yourself, I don't think that, and that you're showing love in what you're putting down in your value statement for yourself, I don't think you're ready for anyone else. And it took me a long time to figure that out, and several relationships later kind of figured that out to say, look, I need that space. I need that time. I have to do the work. But honestly, it's easier if you give yourself that space and time in the beginning than jumping into something else as a replacement.
And it's so important if you think of a relationship with another human, it doesn't matter if it's male or female, older or younger, in terms of net positive energy exchanges. So for example, if I meet you and we both have really good positive energies, so I can feed off you, you feed off me, we were sharing our energies, we walk away from each other a net positive.
Yeah.
Most relationships don't work that way. You have somebody who's a net negative, where they're complaining, they're negative, they're toxic, they're sucking energy away from you. And then when that person leaves, you know, you're depleted. And then if someone else comes in, or TV or alcohol, and sucks the energy out, and pretty soon you're just left with nothing. And I think I now look at relationships and projects and things that I do as net positives for energy exchanges. And so it's just something I do in my own mind. I don't have a formula for it, but it's like, is this person sucking energy for me? And even if it's my fault, I mean, if they're pulling energy for me at 57, what am I waiting around for?
Yeah.
Is Tom going to just change and all of a sudden be nice to me? Or is Tom going to now give me the attention that I thought I deserved because we've been friends for 30 years? Or is Tom just on a different experiential level than I am, and it's time for us to part ways? You know, what's in a very short amount of time, when you and I are both gone, no one's going to care anyway. So I think we just give ourselves way too much credit on what our impact is on this whole lived experience thing. You know, I think it's important that we feel like we're having a sense of, you know, that I have a sense of value to humanity. But in the big picture of things, when I'm gone, I really don't. I really don't. Unless I have FU money and I can leave $1 billion to a charity or something, that's one thing. But most of us don't have that situation. So we have to leave a legacy behind instead of money. So, yeah, it's, I think, again, if I talked to you 6 years ago versus today, you'd see I'm a substantially different thinker as well. You know, I'm just very grateful for the position I'm in right now.
Yeah, I agree. I was a capitalist as well, focused 200% on the business. I was kind of that quote unquote SEAL team leader that was like, burn all the bridges. I've got an elite team. Either you keep up on the team or you can hit the road.
Yeah.
And wasn't afraid to, you know, cut everything down in my path. Very different now, philosophy wise. It sounds like you've had that same experience where you're a different person, different man today.
Yeah, I followed a lot of stoicism back in college. And then when I got married and my life got really busy, I got away from it. But now when I've been through these events, you know, I reflect back to some of the things I learned about reframing, particularly about, you know, I got a sentence I like to close all my talks with that I think you'll love this. I always say at the end of my talks, this is the number one question you can ask yourself. I don't know if you heard me say this earlier, but how you answer this question really dictates and frames the quality of the rest of your life. And here's the question. It's an easy question, but your answer determines everything. Okay. Do things happen to you or do things happen for you? Pretty simple. So go back to death. Seth died. So am I going to punish myself that death came into my life to me? You know, it happened to me. Like, like I didn't do something right, or I missed opportunities. And so everything's a punishment and guilt and shame and anger. Or did death come into my life as an opportunity for me to become a better man? And once you've reframed pretty much every situation in your life, that context, if it's true or not, it doesn't even matter. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So let's say death didn't happen for me. I'll say I am being punished. I don't have to participate in that narrative. I can say it did happen for me. It's opportunistic. I'm not a victim. I'm a victor. You know, I'm on the better road, not the bitter road. And so metaphorically, if you can break things down pretty simple like that, as you go through life and something happens, is this to me or for me?
Yeah.
Now, it's not as easy as that. Trust me. You know, I have very bad moments, and so I'm sure you do too. You know, the Christmas after Prudence died, I don't know how much you want me to share this, but I don't know if you have a lot of rules and regulations on your show.
No, share away.
I had a loaded gun in my head, and that's less than 2 years ago, man. I mean, this is after my book, after my podcast. This is after all the advocacy work I've done. This is after, you know, pretty much. And the scary thing was, is I was at peace. Mm-hmm. I was okay dying. Mm-hmm. That's more scary than the actual act of dying, is that I was okay with it. And even today, now in hindsight, I realize I was at peace. That's like, and it's scary to say that, because any suicide advocate are probably thinking, oh, Jeff, don't say that. That's going to give people that thought that it's okay to kill. No, and that's not my job. I'm not obligated to do that. I'm obligated to share my story and let people pick what they want to pick out of my story. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not my responsibility. I'm not going to trigger someone in suicide. I'm not going to trigger someone out of it. I'm just going to tell my story, then they can take what they want from it. But the fact that I had that gun to my head, Tom, and the fact that I was okay, mm-hmm. is what's terrifying to me.
Yeah.
You know, so that's the only time in this whole journey that I considered ending my life. Even after Seth died, I didn't want to live, but I didn't want to die. I just wanted to sleep and be drunk. But once I got sober and I had to deal with the realities of everything and the pain, and then Prudence dying, and my mom also died right after my wife died. She was, you know, 80 something years old. And that was kind of expected. But my whole point about this whole thing is that even though people looked at me as bulletproof, you know, Mr. Living Undeterred, right? That I was so close to ending it all that I feel compelled to share that story, because I know there's some other person out there that's in the spotlight. We see it every day. You know, Anthony Bourdain. I'm not an Anthony Bourdain, trust me. But it's like we see people that are, people in my favorite heavy metal band, Metal Church. Mike Howe hung himself, and he's my age. And it's like, man, what are we doing? What the heck are we doing wrong? There's something missing, and it's a disconnect that we have with ourselves. I keep going back to that. And that's what I had. I had a disconnect with myself. Fortunately, I didn't pull the trigger. Fortunately, images of my brother, my sons popped in my head, and my wife and my son, Seth, all those things flashed in my eyes. And I could almost see Seth saying, don't do it, Dad. You know, this is, you know, don't do it. You know, and so I didn't do it. And I'm grateful that I made that choice. But again, had I done it, I know I would have left behind tremendous carnage. Mm-hmm. My sons would have been, I don't know how you survive losing a brother, a mom, and a dad, all in that formidable years. Their prefrontal cortex isn't even formed yet.
Yeah.
So it's like, but I didn't. I'm here talking to you, Tom, and you and I are sharing good stories, and we're hopefully helping people. And that's what vulnerability is all about. And that's how I really think we get out of this whole problem. I really do.
I do think there is that really thin line where you can be in that growth mindset, you can be positive, but that pain is still there. And mm-hmm. that pain that day was manifesting in suicidal thoughts.
For you.
You know, you are going to feel that. Don't think that just because we're sitting here doing this podcast,
right,
we've got it all worked out. There are still those days that occur. The good news is they're almost all good for me now.
Yeah, me too.
And those moments are few and far between, but that doesn't mean that that struggle isn't still there. And there's that thin line again that we can fall back to. But I love how you said to you or for you. And when I asked, you know, how do you recommend breaking the loop if someone feels like they're stuck or they're stalled in it? I think that's the secret, is that if you can answer that question, that it wasn't done to you, that the loss mm-hmm. wasn't done to you, that it was for you, mm-hmm. live, become better, learn, whatever it is, that to me is the secret to breaking that loop.
I would fully agree. Yeah. And, you know, having as many arrows in the quiver that you can possibly arm yourself with. And for me, it's been meditation, not drinking alcohol, you know, basically pretty much vegan for the most part, but not all vegan. I don't watch TV. So I've got all these things built around me that keeps me from the abyss. And if I did all those things, it'd be very difficult to keep out of the abyss. I'd be in the abyss constantly.
Yeah, but, walking, exercise, those
but
things.
One thing, you know, you say growth through grief, but there, I love that term. But there's a, you know, post-traumatic growth is an idea out there that's being populated now throughout a lot of media. And there's a lot of authors that have written books on, instead of post-traumatic stress, it's post-traumatic growth. And the first time I heard that, I think it's Robert Tedeschi in the late 70s came up with this, this idea that through trauma, you can have growth.
Yeah.
And again, here's a novel idea. Instead of telling somebody in the military, hey, guess what? You have post-traumatic stress. Why don't we introduce the idea of post-traumatic growth to them?
Yeah.
So they know this thing even exists. Because going back to labels and stigmas and all the stuff that we're trying to break here at Living Undeterred is like, you tell a child that they have attention deficit, and then we add that word disorder at the end of it, which makes my blood curl. It's like, why do we do this? Why do we create these stupid terms, put this label on post-traumatic stress? It's like, boom, you know?
Yeah.
And then you got to go exercise that demon. You have to either go take a pill or you have to go see a therapist. And so they anoint you this label. And I'm like, you don't have to accept it. You don't have to believe you have anything. You know, I don't have to believe I'm grieving. You know, it's my choice. I can choose to grieve. I can choose to believe I'm not grieving, even though if I am, you know, it's such a mental game that we play with each other. And I think there's a lot of really encouraging research down the road for mental health, mental wellness in regards to manipulating things such as even brainwaves and even research in psychedelics, how we can recalibrate the brain. So we can start looking at things as opportunistic as opposed to punishments.
Yeah.
And grief is just such a, I watched my wife, like I said, suicide by alcohol. It's the most helpless feeling in the world. Well, just like what you went through, you know, I mean, alcohol is a disease too. And that's one of the things that I talked to someone the other day. It's like, you know, and I don't mean to say this to be disparaging, but you know, if people who had cancer or diabetes, you know, weren't able to get treatment. And I think right now for people who have addiction, I think it's less than 10% of those that are addicted get treatment. There's no uproar because addiction's a moral failing. Mm-hmm. Seth should have known better, you know, but they don't. But once we identify it as a disease, well, then it's no different than cancer and diabetes, or anything else. But we don't approach that. And it's to me, it's frustrating when I watch advocates that have lost children to alcohol and suicide and things like that. It's almost like the public, they care, but they'd rather give their money to a little child with cancer mm-hmm. or somebody got hit by a drunk driver and killed. It's like that death is more important because they didn't really have a choice. But someone who died from fentanyl, well, they put it in their arm. It's their choice. And that stigma is as a father that have witnessed it, it's sad. It is. If I reach out to people and try to raise money, it's more difficult than if I would have lost my son to something else that would have been more traditional and more acceptable.
Yeah.
But diseases of alcohol and substance abuse are looked at as moral failings. And so, and it's just, I don't know, maybe some of it is, I don't know. I'm not a doctor. I don't know what part of this is nature and what part of it's nurture. And why does it even matter? They're dead.
Yeah. Yeah. What
I mean,
the things that you said was that, you know, we can kind of create our own reality.
Yeah.
And I love that. And I've got the Buddha quote here that's in front of me every day. What you think you become, what you feel you attract, what you imagine you create. And mm-hmm. what you're saying is post-traumatic stress versus post-traumatic growth. If you think it's growth, well, what you think you become, what you imagine
right.
you create. It's going to be a part of what becomes your psyche by having that more positive outlook on it, which then will shape everything around you and it will create that better reality. Talk a little bit before we run out of time about Living Undeterred and what you're doing there and your mission.
Yeah. So Living Undeterred is basically that, first of all, I like that word undeterred because nobody ever used it because it's kind of a clunky word and it's hard to spell. But Living Undeterred just embodies that approach of life is just, you know, resiliency, mental toughness. Those are all words that have already been kind of used in this space. And so Undeterred was there available and I took it and ran with it. And then, you know, right now our big project is with Gen Z trying to right this ship, this massive ship, which represents 70 million Americans and 1/3 of the world's population. And if we don't figure out a way to get this large ship of basically 12 to 26 year olds in a better mental place, then what we're going to leave for them is all for nothing.
Yeah.
They're the most depressed, most anxious, most, you know, lonely generation of all time. There's lots of reasons behind it.
Mm-hmm.
They also are the first generation of all time to acknowledge that mental health is their number one New Year's resolution, which is interesting because that shows that they're hypersensitive to these issues, that they're aware.
Which is a good thing.
30s. Yeah, it is a good thing. But the thing is that as adults is we have to build the processes and the systems to take advantage of that, to help them. And so this summer we're launching Brighten, which is our app, our Gen Z mental health app. And basically what I'm doing, Tom, is I'm taking the idea of financial planning where you plan your finances based on a lot of things, your taxes, your risk level, your income brackets. And I'm taking that approach to mental wellness that we can teach kids how to build their own personal mental wellness plan. And we're talking about diversification, right? Because in a good investment portfolio, you don't want to put all your eggs in one basket. Well, in mental health, we don't do that. We pretty much put our eggs in one basket. My son's egg was Adderall.
Yeah.
And we didn't really deal with all the other issues. And we just take a pill, you know, and that's kind of how our society works. So we want to do is introduce this idea of asset classes for mental health. So we came up with health, wealth, and purpose as the three core asset classes for mental health. So our app is going to autonomously allow kids to build their own plan. Some kids aren't going to be interested. That's fine. We're not here to save every kid, but we want to empower those kids that do want to start working on their mental health, give them an option to do it in a creative, fun way. That's very simple, non-clinical. Mm-hmm. We don't need to be telling our kids they have attention deficit disorder. Next time I hear someone say that, I don't know what I'm going to do. I get so frustrated hearing that term. And let's see what happens. I mean, we have to do something. What we're doing isn't working. Mm-hmm. It's pretty clear. You look at all the numbers from the deaths of despair, you know,
yeah.
Overdose, suicide, alcohol, 825 Americans a day, 825 Americans a day. I mean, man, that's a lot of despair.
Yeah, you can argue about some of the survey results. Maybe you think that survey wasn't done right. You can mm-hmm. argue with the death figures, which are
right.
the roof when it comes to the death of despair
yeah.
right now. And is it COVID? Is it technology? I mean, go down the list. There's a long list of contributors, but we've got to do something about it because, as you said, it's at crisis level.
Yeah, and you know that there's so many different ways to kind of look at this, but if you look at what is currently running the world, it's fear and scarcity, right? That's what it is. And the unfortunate thing is that there's so much love and abundance out there. Mm-hmm. We're just not being shown it.
And scarcity gets your reptilian brain in act.
Yeah.
And gets you motivated right. to join a movement or to buy a product, right?
Or right.
take a drug. And that's what we're being fed all the time.
I had a lady on my podcast last week. She said something that was so profound. We were talking about nature, you know, getting back to nature. And that's the thing that kids miss. And even adults, I mean, just to get out and walk in your yard and lay in the grass. And I mean, seriously, just kind of become one with the earth is such a beautiful thing. But, and she said, you know, we don't have attention deficit disorder. We have nature deficit disorder. And I thought, man, what a great, that is so true.
Yeah.
I mean, I sit here and look out my back window and I got these huge yards out there and kind of some woods and there's a creek and all these houses have kids and stuff. And do you know how many times I see kids out playing?
Yeah.
Never, man.
Good enough.
I had three brothers. We were never in the house.
Yeah.
We were building forts. We were jumping over garbage cans with our bikes and breaking arms and getting bit by snakes mm-hmm. and, you know, falling out of trees and starting fires. And, you know, it's just, we don't do that anymore.
Yeah.
We've just got so far away from connecting to the earth, and it's so sad. And that's why this generation needs to start looking at things quite differently, you know, or one third of the world's population, which is going to inherit everything that we're going to leave them in the next 20 or 30 years. It's going to be really tough to come back from that.
Yeah. If you're in a rut in your grief, my best advice, go out, take a walk in nature. Yeah. You will feel completely different. A walk in the woods. Helen, our mental health expert, and I had this discussion the other day about just how healing it is to get into nature and do that.
You know, Tom, one thing I do, I'll jump in real quick. I know you want to wrap this up, but that's really been helpful for me with nature is my love for the ocean. Mm-hmm. And I'm a certified scuba diver, been diving for a long time. But after Seth died, I got my youngest son certified, Roman. So now we go on like two week-long trips a year, all over, mostly the Caribbean. But that's been something that I forgot how much I really enjoyed. And my respect for the ocean grew after I buried Seth and Prudence. And when you're in the ocean and you're diving, you know, 80, 90 feet down, especially at night when you're doing a night dive, it's surreal. It's hard to explain.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like if there is a heaven, it's almost like experiencing it while you're still here.
Yeah.
It's just so beautiful. And so if I could say one thing to your listeners, if they could grasp onto something like that, you know, whether it's golf or, you know, anything, fishing, just something to get outside, you know, and really embrace what's out there instead of sitting behind your computer all day, scrolling through, you know, or on Twitter.
Yeah.
Just watching videos of people fighting at McDonald's and things like that. It's like, I know it's captivating and that's, you know, we're rubbernecking all the time going down the highway, looking at car accidents, but we've got to find a way to pull ourselves away from this.
Completely agree. Folks can find and reach you online. How, Jeff?
I'll give you my email. It's jeff@livingundeterred.org. Our website is, we have two. We have livingundeterred.com and livingundeterred.org. But what I would encourage your listeners to do is to sign up on our landing page for our app. That's my most intensive project coming. That's in July of 2023. And it's just www.brightenyourlife.com. And Brighten is spelled B-R-I-G-H-T-N, yourlife.com. And that's, you'll get updates on the launch and all that stuff. But that's kind of where all my projects are kind of coming to this convergence, Tom, is I really feel that my value to society is Gen Z. And that's, I can't get a 47-year-old housewife to stop drinking wine. I can't get a 24-year-old kid to stop doing drugs. But I think I can get to the kids.
Yeah. That's amazing.
You know,
you've got incredible purpose. Keep doing what you're doing. Living Undeterred, wishing you all the best with the new app as well and the launch. Thank you. Thank you for participating with us. Thank you all for listening into our Growth Through Grief podcast. If you like what you heard, please hit the like button, leave a review. If you like what you heard, please give us your feedback and comments and be sure to subscribe so you can stay up to date latest episodes. Until next time, my growth warriors, keep growing.